scared," Dinah whispered. "We all look like monsters to that man."
"No, I don't think so," Laurel said, surprised and a little taken aback.
"Why would you think a thing like that?"
"I don't know,"
Dinah said. She liked this woman, had liked her from the instant she heard her voice. But she had no intention of telling Laurel that for just a moment she had seen them all, herself included, looking back at the man with the loud voice. She had been inside the man with the loud voice. His name was Mr. Toombs, or Mr. Tunney, or something like that, and to him they looked like a bunch of evil, selfish trolls. If she told Miss Lee something like that, Miss Lee would think she was crazy. Why would this woman, whom Dinah had just met, think any different? So Dinah said nothing. Laurel kissed the girl's cheek. The skin was hot beneath her lips.
"Don't be scared, honey. We're going along just as smooth as can be. Can't you feel it? And in just a few hours, we'll be safe on the ground again."
"That's good. I want my Aunt Vicky, though. Where is she, do you think?"
"I don't know, hon," Laurel said. "I wish I did." Dinah thought again of the faces the yelling man saw. Evil faces, cruel faces. She thought of her own face as he perceived it. A piggish baby face with eyes hidden behind huge black lenses. Her courage broke then, and she began to weep in horse-racking sobs that hurt Laurel's heart. She held the girl because it was the only thing she could think of to do, and soon she was crying herself. They cried together for nearly 5 minutes, and then Dinah began to calm again. Laurel looked over at the slim young boy, whose name was either Albert or Alvin, she could not remember which, and saw that his eyes were also wet. He caught her looking and glanced hastily down at his hands. Dinah fetched one final gasping sob and then just lay with her head pillowed against Laurel's breast.
"I guess crying won't help, huh?"
"No, I guess not," Laurel agreed. "Why don't you try going to sleep, Dinah?" Dinah sighed a watery, unhappy sound.
"I don't think I can. I was asleep."
"Tell me about it," Laurel thought. And Flight 29 continued east at 36,000 feet, flying at over 500 miles an hour above the dark midsection of America.
"That little girl said something interesting an hour or so ago," Robert Jenkins said suddenly. The little girl in question had gone to sleep again in the meantime, despite her doubts about her ability to do so. Albert Costner also had been nodding, perchance to return once more to those mythic streets of Tombstone. He had taken his violin case down from the overhead compartment and was holding it across his lap.
"Huh?" he said, and straightened up.
"I'm sorry," Jenkins said. "Were you dozing?"
"No,"
Albert said. "Wide awake." He turned two large bloodshot orbs on Jenkins to prove this. A darker shadow lay under each. Jenkins thought he looked a little like a raccoon which had been startled while raiding garbage cans.
"What did she say?"
"She told Miss Stevenson she didn't think she could get back to sleep because she had been sleeping earlier."
Albert gazed at Dinah for a moment.
"Well, she's out now," he said.
"I see she is, but that is not the point, dear boy. Not the point at all."
Albert considered telling Mr. Jenkins that Ace Costner, the fastest Hebrew west of the Mississippi and the only Texan to survive the Battle of the Alamo, did not much cotton to being called dear boy, and decided to let it pass, at least for the time being.
"Then what is the point?"
"I was also asleep, corked off even before the captain, our original captain, I mean, turned off the no-smoking light. I've always been that way, trains, buses, planes. I drift off like a baby the minute they turn on the motors. What about you, dear boy?"
"What about me, what?"
"Were you asleep? You were, weren't you?"
"Well, yeah."
"We were all asleep. The people who disappeared were all awake."
Albert thought about this. "Well, maybe."
"Nonsense," Jenkins said almost jovially. "I write mysteries for a living. Deduction is my bread and butter, you might say. Don't you think that if someone had been awake when all those people were eliminated, that person would have screamed bloody murder, waking the rest of us?"
"I guess so," Albert agreed thoughtfully. "Except maybe for that guy all the way in the back. I don't think an air raid siren would wake that guy up."
"All right. Your exception is duly noted.
But no one screamed, did they? And no one has offered to tell the rest of us what happened, so I deduce that only waking passengers were subtracted, along with the flight crew, of course.
Yeah, maybe so.
You look troubled, dear boy. Your expression says that, despite its charms, the idea does not scan perfectly for you. May I ask why not? Have I missed something? Jenkins' expression said he didn't believe that was possible, but that his mother had raised him to be polite.
I don't know, Albert said honestly. How many of us are there?
11?
Yes, counting the fellow in the back, the one who was comatose.
We number 11.
If you're right, shouldn't there be more of us?
Why? But Albert fell silent, struck by a sudden vivid image from his childhood. He had been raised in a theological twilight zone by parents who were not Orthodox, but who were not agnostics either. He and his brothers had grown up observing most of the dietary traditions, or laws, or whatever they were. They had had their bar mitzvahs, and they had been raised to know who they were, where they came from, and what that was supposed to mean. And the story Albert remembered most clearly from his childhood visits to temple was the story of the final plague which had been visited on Pharaoh, the gruesome tribute exacted by God's dark angel of the morning. In his mind's eye, he now saw that angel moving not over Egypt, but through Flight 29, gathering most of the passengers to its terrible breast, not because they had neglected to daub their lintels, or their seat-backs, perhaps, with the blood of a lamb, but because... Why? Because why? Albert didn't know, but he shivered just the same, and wished that creepy old story had never occurred to him. Let my frequent flyers go, he thought. Except it wasn't funny. Albert, Mr. Jenkins' voice seemed to come from a long way off. Albert, are you all right?
Yes, just thinking. He cleared his throat.
If all the sleeping passengers were, you know, passed over, there'd be at least 60 of us, maybe more. I mean, this is the red eye.
Dear boy, have you ever...
Could you call me Albert, Mr. Jenkins? That's my name. Jenkins patted Albert's shoulder.
I'm sorry, really. I don't mean to be patronizing. I'm upset, and when I'm upset, I have a tendency to retreat, like a turtle pulling his head back into a shell. Only what I retreat into is fiction. I believe I was playing Philo Vance. He's a detective, a great detective, created by the late S.S. Van Dyne. I suppose you've never read him. Hardly anyone does these days, which is a pity, at any rate. I apologize.
It's okay, Albert said uncomfortably. Albert, you are, and Albert, you shall be from now on, Robert Jenkins promised.
I started to ask you if you've ever taken the red eye before.
No, I've never even flown across the country before.
Well, I have, many times. On a few occasions, I have even gone against my natural inclination and stayed awake for a while. Mostly when I was a younger man and the flights were noisier. Having said that much, I may as well date myself outrageously by admitting that my first coast-to-coast trip was on a TWA prop job that made two stops.
To refuel.
My observation is that very few people go to sleep on such flights during the first hour or so. And then just about everyone goes to sleep. During that first hour, people occupy themselves with looking at the scenery, talking with their spouses or traveling companions, having a drink or two.
Settling in, you mean, Albert suggested.
What Mr. Jenkins was saying made perfect sense to him, although he had done precious little settling in himself. He had been so excited about his coming journey and the new life which would be waiting for him that he had hardly slept at all during the last couple of nights. As a result, he had gone out like a light almost as soon as the 767 left the ground.
Making little nests for themselves, Jenkins agreed. Did you happen to notice the drinks trolley outside the cockpit,
Albert?
I saw it was there, Albert agreed.
Jenkins' eyes shone.
Yes, indeed. It was either see it or fall over it. But did you really notice it?
I guess not, if you saw something I didn't.
It's not the eye that notices, but the mind, Albert. The trained deductive mind.
I'm no Sherlock Holmes, but I did notice that it had just been taken out of the small closet in which it is stored, and that the used glasses from the pre-flight service were still stacked on the bottom shelf.
From this, I deduced the following. The plane took off uneventfully. It climbed toward its cruising altitude, and the autopilot device was fortunately engaged. Then the captain turned off the seatbelt light. This would all be about 30 minutes into the flight, if I'm reading the signs correctly, about 1 a.m. PDT. When the seatbelt light was turned out, the stewardesses arose and began their first task, cocktails for about 150 at 24,000 feet and rising. The pilot, meanwhile, has programmed the autopilot to level the plane off at 36,000 feet and fly east on heading thus and such. A few passengers, 11 of us, in fact, have fallen asleep. Of the rest, some are dozing, perhaps, but not deeply enough to save them from whatever happened. And the rest are all wide awake. Building their nests, Albert said. Exactly! Building their nests! Jenkins paused and then added, not without some melodrama, and then it happened. What happened, Mr. Jenkins? Albert asked. Do you have any ideas about that? Jenkins did not answer for a long time, and when he finally did, a lot of the fun had gone out of his voice. Listening to him, Albert understood for the first time that beneath the slightly theatrical veneer, Robert Jenkins was as frightened as Albert was himself. He found he did not mind this. It made the elderly mystery writer in his running-to-seed sport coat seem more real. The locked room mystery is the tale of deduction at its most pure, Jenkins said. I've written a few of them myself, more than a few, to be completely honest, but I never expected to be a part of one. Albert looked at him and could think of no reply. He found himself remembering a Sherlock Holmes story called The Speckled Band. In that story, a poisonous snake had gotten into the famous locked room through a ventilating duct. The immortal Sherlock hadn't even had to wake up all his brain cells to solve that one. But even if the overhead luggage compartments of Flight 29 had been filled with poisonous snakes, stuffed with them, where were the bodies? Where were the bodies? Fear began to creep into him again, seeming to flow up his legs toward his vitals. He reflected that he had never felt less like that famous gunslinger, Ace Costner, in his whole life. If it were just the plane, Jenkins went on softly, I suppose I could come up with the scenario. It is, after all, how I have been earning my daily bread for the last 25 years or so. Would you like to hear one such scenario?
Sure,
Albert said. Very well. Let us say that some shadowy government organization like The Shop has decided to carry out an experiment, and we are the test subjects. The purpose of such an experiment, given the circumstances, might be to document the effects of severe mental and emotional stress on a number of average Americans. They, the scientists running the experiment, load the airplane's oxygen system with some sort of odorless hypnotic drug.
Are there such things? Albert asked, fascinated.
There are indeed, Jenkins said. Diazoline for one. Methoprominol for another. I remember when readers who like to think of themselves as serious-minded laughed at Sax Rohmer's Fu Manchu novels. They called them panting melodrama at its most shameful. Jenkins shook his head slowly. Now, thanks to biological research and the paranoia of alphabet agencies like the CIA and the DIA, we're living in a world that could be Sax Rohmer's worst nightmare. Diazoline, which is actually a nerve gas, would be best. It's supposed to be very fast. After it is released into the air, everyone falls asleep, except for the pilot, who is breathing uncontaminated air through a mask. But, Albert began. Jenkins smiled and raised a hand. I know what your objection is, Albert, and I can explain it. Allow me. Albert nodded. The pilot lands the plane at a secret airstrip in Nevada, let us say. The passengers who were awake when the gas was released, and the stewardesses, of course, are offloaded by sinister men wearing white Andromeda strain suits. The passengers who were asleep, you and I among them, my young friend, simply go on sleeping, only a little more deeply than before. The pilot then returns Flight 29 to its proper altitude and heading. He engages the autopilot. As the plane reaches the Rockies, the effects of the gas begin to wear off. Diazoline is a so-called clear drug, one that leaves no appreciable after effects, no hangover, in other words. Over his intercom, the pilot can hear the little blind girl crying out for her aunt. He knows she will wake the others. The experiment is about to commence, so he gets up and leaves the cockpit, closing the door behind him.
How could he do that?
There's no knob on the outside. Jenkins waved a dismissive hand. Simplest thing in the world, Albert. He uses a strip of adhesive tape, sticky side out. Once the door latches from the inside, it's locked. A smile of admiration began to overspread Albert's face, and then it froze. In that case, the pilot would be one of us, he said. Yes and no. In my scenario, Albert, the pilot is the pilot. The pilot who just happened to be on board, supposedly dead-heading to Boston. The pilot who was sitting in first class, less than 30 feet from the cockpit door when the manure hit the fan.
Captain Angle, Albert said in a low, horrified voice.
Jenkins replied in the pleased but complacent tone of a geometry professor who had just written QED below the proof of a particularly difficult theorem. Captain Angle, he agreed. Neither of them noticed Krunek looking at them with glittering, feverish eyes. Now Krunek took the in-flight magazine from the seat pocket in front of him, pulled off the cover, and began to tear it in long, slow strips. He let them flutter to the floor, where they joined the shreds of the cocktail napkin around his brown loafers. His lips were moving soundlessly. Had Albert been a student of the New Testament, he would have understood how Saul, that most zealous persecutor of the early Christians, must have felt when the scales fell from his eyes on the road to Damascus. He stared at Robert Jenkins with shining enthusiasm, every vestige of sleepiness banished from his brain. Of course, when you thought about it, or when someone like Mr. Jenkins, who was clearly a real head, ratty sport coat or no ratty sport coat, thought about it for you, it was just too big and too obvious to miss. Almost the entire cast and crew of American Pride's Flight 29 had disappeared between the Mojave Desert and the Great Divide. But one of the few survivors just happened to be, surprise, surprise, another American Pride pilot who was, in his own words, qualified to fly this make and model, also to land it. Jenkins had been watching Albert closely, and now he smiled. There wasn't much humor in that smile. It's a tempting scenario, he said, isn't it? We'll have to capture him as soon as we land, Albert said, scraping one hand feverishly up the side of his face. You, me, Mr. Gaffney, and that British guy. He looks tough. Only, what if the Brit's in on it, too? He could be Captain Engel's, you know, bodyguard, just in case someone figured things out the way you did. Jenkins opened his mouth to reply, but Albert rushed on before he could. We'll just have to put the arm on them both, somehow. He offered Mr. Jenkins a narrow smile, an Ace Costner smile, cool, tight, dangerous. The smile of a man who is faster than blue blazes and knows it. I may not be the world's smartest guy, Mr. Jenkins, but I'm nobody's lab rat.
But it doesn't stand up, you know, Jenkins said mildly.
Albert blinked.
What?
The scenario I just outlined for you, it doesn't stand up. But you said,
I said, if it were just the plane.
I could come up with a scenario, and I did, a good one.
If it was a book idea, I'll bet my agent could sell it.
Unfortunately, it isn't just the plane. Denver might still have been down there, but all the lights were off,
if it was.
I have been coordinating our route of travel with my wristwatch, and I can tell you now that it's not just Denver either. Omaha, Des Moines, no sign of them down there in the dark, my boy. I have seen no lights at all, in fact. No farmhouses, no grain storage and shipping locations, no interstate turnpikes. Those things show up at night, you know, with the new high-intensity lighting. They show up very well, even when one is almost 6 miles up. The land is utterly dark.
Now, I can believe that there might be a government agency unethical enough to drug us all in order to observe our reactions. Hypothetically, at least. What I cannot believe is that even the shop could have persuaded everyone over our flight path to turn off their lights in order to reinforce the illusion that we are all alone.
Well, maybe it's all a fake, Albert suggested.
Maybe we're really still on the ground and everything we can see outside the windows is, you know, projected. I saw a movie something like that once.
Jenkins shook his head slowly, regretfully.
I'm sure it was an interesting film, but I don't believe it would work in real life.
Unless our theoretical secret agency has perfected some sort of ultra-wide-screen 3D projection, I think not.
Whatever is happening is not just going on inside the plane, Albert. And that is where deduction breaks down.
But the pilot, Albert said wildly. What about him just happening to be here at the right place and time?
Are you a baseball fan, Albert?
Huh?
No, I mean, sometimes I watch the Dodgers on TV, but not really.
Well, let me tell you what may be the most amazing statistic ever recorded in a game which thrives on statistics. In 1957, Ted Williams reached base on 16 consecutive at-bats. This streak encompassed six baseball games. In 1941, Joe DiMaggio batted safely in 56 straight games. But the odds against what DiMaggio did pale next to the odds against Williams's accomplishment, which have been put somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 billion to 1. Baseball fans like to say DiMaggio's streak will never be equaled. I disagree. But I'd be willing to bet that if they're still playing baseball 1,000 years from now, Williams's 16 on bases in a row will still stand.
All of which means what?
It means that I believe Captain Engel's presence on board tonight is nothing more or less than an accident, like Ted Williams's 16 consecutive on bases. And considering our circumstances, I'd say it's a very lucky accident indeed. If life was like a mystery novel, Albert, where coincidence is not allowed and the odds are never beaten for long, it would be a much tidier business. I've found, though, that in real life, coincidence is not the exception, but the rule.
Then what is happening? Albert whispered.
Jenkins uttered a long, uneasy sigh.
I'm the wrong person to ask, I'm afraid. It's too bad Larry Niven or John Varley isn't on board.
Who are those guys?
Science fiction writers, Jenkins said.
I don't suppose you read science fiction, do you? Nick Hopewell asked suddenly. Brian turned around to look at him. Nick had been sitting quietly in the navigator's seat since Brian had taken control of Flight 29 almost 2 hours ago now. He had listened wordlessly as Brian continued trying to reach someone, anyone, on the ground or in the air. I was crazy about it as a kid, Brian said. You? Nick smiled. Until I was 18 or so, I firmly believed that the Holy Trinity consisted of Robert Heinlein, John Christopher, and John Wyndham. I've been sitting here and running all those old stories through my head, matey, and thinking about such exotic things as time warps and space warps and alien raiding parties. Brian nodded. He felt relieved. It was good to know he wasn't the only one who was thinking crazy thoughts. I mean, we don't really have any way of knowing if anything is left down there, do we? No, Brian said, we don't. Over Illinois, low-lying clouds had blotted out the dark bulk of the earth far below the plain. He was sure it still was the earth. The Rockies had looked reassuringly familiar, even from 36,000 feet. But beyond that, he was sure of nothing. And the cloud cover might hold all the way to Bangor. With air traffic control out of commission, he had no real way of knowing. Brian had been playing with a number of scenarios, and the most unpleasant of the lot was this, that they would come out of the clouds and discover that every sign of human life, including the airport where he hoped to land, was gone. Where would he put this bird down then? I've always found waiting the hardest part, Nick said. The hardest part of what, Brian wondered, but he did not ask. Suppose you took us down to 5,000 feet or so, Nick proposed suddenly. Just for a quick look-see,
Perhaps the sight of a few small towns and interstate highways will set our minds at rest. Brian had already considered this idea, had considered it with great longing. It's tempting, he said, but I can't do it. Why not? The passengers are still my first responsibility, Nick. They'd probably panic even if I explained what I was going to do in advance. I'm thinking of our loudmouth friend with the pressing appointment at the Prue in particular. The one whose nose you twisted? I can handle him, Nick replied. Any others who cut up rough as well? I'm sure you can, Brian said. But I still see no need of scaring them unnecessarily. And we will find out eventually. We can't stay up here forever, you know. Too true, matey, Nick said dryly. I might do it anyway if I could be sure I could get under the cloud cover at 4,000 or 5,000 feet. But with no ATC and no other planes to talk to, I can't be sure. I don't even know for sure what the weather's like down there. And I'm not talking about normal stuff either. You can laugh at me if you want to. I'm not laughing, matey. I'm not even close to laughing, believe me. Well, suppose we have gone through a time warp like in a science fiction story. What if I took us down through the clouds and we got one quick look at a bunch of brontosauruses grazing in some Farmer John's field before we were torn apart by a cyclone or fried in an electrical storm? Do you really think that's possible? Nick asked. Brian looked at him closely to see if the question was sarcastic. It didn't appear to be, but it was hard to tell. The British were famous for their dry sense of humor, weren't they? Brian started to tell him he had once seen something just like that on an old Twilight Zone episode and then decided it wouldn't help his credibility at all. It's pretty unlikely, I suppose, but you get the idea. We just don't know what we're dealing with. We might hit a brand new mountain in what used to be upstate New York, or another plane. Hell, maybe even a rocket shuttle. After all, if it's a time warp, we could as easily be in the future as in the past. Nick looked out through the window. We seem to have the sky pretty much to ourselves. Up here, that's true. Down there, who knows? And who knows is a very dicey situation for an airline pilot. I intend to overfly Bangor when we get there, if these clouds still hold. I'll take us out over the Atlantic and drop under the ceiling as we head back. Our odds will be better if we make our initial descent over water. So, for now, we just go on. Right. And wait. Right again. Nick sighed. Well, you're the captain. Brian smiled. That's three in a row. Deep in the trenches carved into the floors of the Pacific and the Indian Oceans, there are fish which live and die without ever seeing or sensing the sun. These fabulous creatures cruise the depths like ghostly balloons, lit from within by their own radiance. Although they look delicate, they are actually marvels of biological design, built to withstand pressures that would squash a man as flat as a window pane in the blink of an eye. Their great strength, however, is also their great weakness. Prisoners of their own alien bodies, they are locked forever in their dark depths. If they are captured and drawn toward the surface, toward the sun, they simply explode. It is not external pressure that destroys them, but its absence. Craig Toomey had been raised in his own dark trench, had lived in his own atmosphere of high pressure. His father had been an executive in the Bank of America, away from home for long stretches of time, a caricature type A overachiever. He drove his only child as furiously and as unforgivingly as he drove himself. The bedtime stories he told Craig in Craig's early years terrified the boy. Nor was this surprising, because terror was exactly the emotion Roger Toomey meant to awaken in the boy's breast. These tales concerned themselves, for the most part, with a race of monstrous beings called the Langoliers. Their job, their mission in life, in the world of Roger Toomey, everything had a job, everything had serious work to do, was to prey on lazy, time-wasting children. By the time he was 7, Craig was a dedicated type A overachiever, just like Daddy. He had made up his mind. The Langoliers were never going to get him. A report card which did not contain all A's was an unacceptable report card. An A-minus was the subject of a lecture fraught with dire warnings of what life would be like digging ditches or emptying garbage cans. And a B resulted in punishment, most commonly confinement to his room for a week. During that week,
Craig was allowed out only for school and for meals. There was no time off for good behavior. On the other hand, extraordinary achievement, the time Craig won the tri-school decathlon, for instance, warranted no corresponding praise. When Craig showed his father the medal which had been awarded him on that occasion in an assembly before the entire student body, his father glanced at it, grunted once, and went back to his newspaper.